connected by purpose, driven by passion. This is Children's Healthcare Canada's Spark Conversations podcast series.
Welcome to Spark Conversations, Children's Healthcare Canada's monthly podcast series. At the crossroads of children's healthcare, system improvement, and leadership, Spark Conversations is a solution-focused podcast that connects the child health community with system leaders who tackle wicked problems and discuss ideas to inform the development of innovative and integrated systems serving children and youth. Spark Conversations is one component of our Spark Knowledge Mobilization Program, and Spark is the shared platform for advocacy, research, and knowledge. I'm Paula Robeson, and today I'm delighted to be speaking with Dr. Manish Satarangani. Dr. Satarangani has been director of the Vaccine Evaluation Center since 2016. He's a tenured associate professor at the University of British Columbia. He completed a doctorate at Oxford Vaccine Group in the UK, developing novel meningococcal vaccines, and a fellowship in pediatric infectious diseases in Vancouver, following which he returned to Oxford to work as a pediatric infectious disease physician. Since the start of the pandemic, Manish has led and collaborated on clinical studies to increase understanding of the epidemiology and transmission of SARS-CoV-2, immune responses to natural infection and vaccination, and safety of COVID-19 vaccines, including COVID-19 vaccine trials. And recently, Dr. Satarangani was the recipient of the Pediatric Chairs of Canada 2021 Emerging Academic Leader Award. Today, we're chatting about applying what we've learned from COVID to improve the uptake of routine vaccinations in children. Dr. Satarangani, welcome to Spark Conversations podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Paula, and I'm thrilled to be able to join you for this conversation today. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Manish. You're a very successful pediatrician, infectious disease specialist, and researcher, and have unique expertise in translational vaccinology. Can you begin by telling me a little bit about yourself and how you got where you are today?
Sure. So my journey has taken me around the world, which I feel very fortunate to have had lots of opportunities. My medical training was mostly in the UK. So I did medical school in the UK in Cambridge and Oxford. I then spent some time working in Oxford before going to work in Australia for a few months. I came back to the UK to start my pediatric clinical training and did that in London, which is my hometown and still very dear to me. And after the initial first couple of years of my pediatric training, I went to Kenya in Africa, had a wonderful opportunity there. And that's when I really got hooked on clinical research. Prior to that, I'd done some lab research, which wasn't a great experience for me when I was at medical school, but really that experience in Kenya had a transformative effect. And I think after that point, I kind of knew that research was always going to be part of my future. So I went back to the UK, completed my general pediatric training in Oxford, came to Vancouver for a fellowship in pediatric infectious diseases. And I think bringing together the two things I enjoyed the most at medical school, so pediatrics and infectious diseases, had a bit more time in the UK completing my clinical training. As part of all of that, during the clinical training, I had done my PhD with the Oxford Vaccine Group. And then an opportunity came along for me to return to Vancouver in a faculty position and to take on the role as director of the Vaccine Evaluation Center. And it was really, I think if I had was able to write my own job description, I don't think I could write something any better than the job I landed up with. So I feel, again, very lucky to have had that opportunity. And really, since then, you know, over the last 6 years or so, have been here working in pediatric infectious disease and doing vaccine research, which really covers the breadth of vaccinology from epidemiology, population level studies, clinical trials of new and existing vaccines, and laboratory science, so we can better understand immune responses to the vaccines we have and to new vaccines, all with the goal of really improving vaccine programs for the future. And important to me is having a lot of global collaborators so we can improve the health not only here in Canada, but worldwide.
How exciting for you that you do what you love, and it sounds like very busy doing it.
Yes, no, but busy is good for me. It's good to do something to keep the mind occupied.
Definitely. Since the start of the pandemic, you've been leading research, as you mentioned, to increase the understanding about COVID transmission, immune responses, natural infection, and vaccination and the safety of the COVID vaccines. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and other ongoing research that you're conducting?
Sure. And I think it's been fantastic from a research side to sort of have gone through this journey over the last 2 years or so with the pandemic, starting from the point of having a completely new pathogen, having almost no information about it, to within a year having vaccines that needed evaluating, et cetera. So I think to me that really has taken me full circle around my full kind of research repertoire, if you like. So from the beginning, you know, some of the questions were around who is getting infected with this virus, where the transmission is occurring. And, you know, it was obvious from the beginning that children did not seem to be affected as much as adults, but we had no real understanding. As a pediatrician, that was something that I really wanted to focus on. And so we started a study where we were looking at antibodies against SARS-CoV-2 in children across British Columbia to really get a proper understanding of how many people were infected, who was infected, you know, what were the differences, knowing that just relying on testing data for children was not going to be accurate. You know, so we started with that. We sort of built on that, you know, understanding the epidemiology, doing a household transmission study. So looking at how the virus is transmitted within households and the differences between children and adults. As vaccines have become available, we have moved on to do vaccine trials in children as well as adults as well. And then on the back of those, really doing work in the lab to try and understand the immune response to the vaccines in children and in adults and looking at how they respond. And then as vaccines have been implemented, studies to look at a population level at the safety of the vaccines. And then what has happened to the disease? What is the vaccine effectiveness? So it's really we've come full circle from knowing nothing to being able to evaluate these vaccine programs. And I think for the work that we're doing outside of COVID, that really, you know, follows a similar pathway, that with different vaccines and different diseases, we're looking at different elements of those, whether it's the population level work to understand the epidemiology, the clinical trials, the immune responses to different vaccines, or the vaccine effectiveness. And it's been incredible with COVID to be able to do all of that with a single pathogen. Usually you're at one or other stage of the vaccine development and implementation program. So for example, we're doing trials right now of meningococcal and pneumococcal vaccines, which prevent against meningitis in children, to see how we can use these vaccines better. But these are vaccines that have been around for many, many years. And so it's been quite the journey of discovery.
Oh, no doubt. And a rapid one as well.
Absolutely. And we've had to move quickly with times. We have had to move with vaccine programs being rolled out, booster programs being rolled out, and lots of pivoting and lots of protocol amendments along the way.
So your team is definitely agile.
Absolutely. We have, you know, they're much bigger. So at the beginning of the pandemic at the Vaccine Evaluation Center, we had around 30 people here, including the investigators, students and staff. And we rapidly grew, and we've got around 90 people now getting all this work done. And it really is a team effort. There's no way that this is really a small number of individuals. It really takes a huge team to make all this happen.
For sure. What do your experiences with COVID, both positive and negative, tell us all about the promotion of vaccine uptake and confidence related to routine childhood immunizations?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think it's maybe worth reflecting briefly on where we are with the childhood immunization program, or where we were before COVID. So at least in British Columbia, if you look at fully up-to-date children at 2 years or 7 years of age, you're looking at rates of around 70 to 75%, which is way below the standard, both within BC, but also nationally. The standard, we're aiming for 95% uptake of all of our vaccines. And so on the positive side, I think we've seen with COVID that getting up to and above 90% is achievable. So, you know, we've seen with the program in adults and in adolescents, we've got over 90% for the most part for most populations. And so I think to me that has been incredible, to see a vaccine that has been developed and rolled out very quickly, that we have managed to get uptake to that level. So to me that shows that this is possible. And so these targets that are set of 90-95%, it's not pie in the sky, it's totally achievable goals. I think on the downside, we've also seen that, at least early in the pandemic, with redeployment of resources and staff, we saw a drop in immunization services. So we have had to figure out how to catch those kids up who missed certain doses, particularly in the school-based program, for example. We've also seen for COVID, the uptake in the 5 to 11-year-olds has not been as high as in the older children. I think there's a lot of lessons there in terms of what drives people to get vaccines and what drives them to get vaccines for their kids. And the understanding, I think understanding the differences between the decision-making that people take on when they're making decisions for themselves and the decisions that they're making for their children. And these are slightly different. So I think that we've really been able to understand that a bit more. And I'm hoping that we can continue moving forward with the routine childhood immunization program and get up to those 90-95% levels that we really need. Because I think as we hopefully emerge from this pandemic, the last thing we want to see is outbreaks of other vaccine preventable diseases like measles. I think that would be a real tragedy.
Oh, definitely. As the mom of a toddler at the time who had whooping cough, I can completely understand the need to prevent these conditions. Would COVID vaccines for children and youth become part of routine childhood vaccinations?
That's a really great question. And in some ways, it is the big question that we honestly, the short answer is we don't know right now. So we've seen that up to now, the waves of the pandemic have come and gone a little bit of an unpredictable way. Some of it relates to how public health restrictions have come and gone. And clearly, the more stringent the public health restrictions are, the more controlled the disease is. But there's a limit to how long we can go on living in this very restricted way. And so over time, those restrictions have lessened, which is totally appropriate. But the other thing that we have seen is evolution of the virus and new variants emerging. And again, that's still a little bit unpredictable. We have large pockets of the world where the vaccine uptake, unfortunately, is very low. And so there is a lot of virus transmission happening in those settings, which may be more likely to cause evolution and new variants emerging. So I think we're still in that phase where it hasn't quite settled down into a routine pattern. I think going forward, if we end up with this virus going the same way as the other respiratory viruses and other coronaviruses, where we see a peak over the winter and then very little disease or at least less disease over the summer, then one can envisage that, you know, it may be warranted to have an annual program in a similar way to influenza. But I think one of the key parts of that would be how severe the disease ends up being from year to year and in different populations. So now that we have a very different situation to the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was susceptible to this disease, we have a population which is largely immune to the disease. And so if we see disease occurring that is not severe or maybe is only severe in certain populations, it may be that the right thing would be to have a targeted program at those high-risk populations, whether that's based on age, so maybe the seniors and the youngest children, maybe it's based on presence of other medical conditions. These are data that we're still trying to identify who is at highest risk. If we end up having seasonal waves that come and have a severe effect across the population, then that would justify a more universal program. So I think this is very much a kind of watch this space. I think we have to be ready for all occasions. And I think we also don't know moving forward how the variants might escape from vaccine immunity. And so we might have a situation where the vaccines are 90% plus effective against new variants. We may have situations where they're much less effective. And so I think we're really going to have to take that as it comes. I think the good thing is that with influenza, where we have a seasonal program, we do have a clear approach that has been used for influenza where new vaccines and new variant vaccines can be made every year. And I think with the newer technologies we've had based on things like mRNA and viral vectors, we have the ability to respond to new variants much quicker than we used to.
Is there more we can do to improve vaccine and science communication in general, vaccine communications, but science communication more generally, to reduce the confusion, the mis and disinformation, and the complacency we see with regard to vaccine uptake?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's always room to improve the sort of scientific literacy of the general population. I think that we've done a pretty good job, actually, over the last couple of years. I think, you know, now some of the conversations that I have with friends who, you know, not medical, not science related, and we're having these conversations around intervals between vaccine doses and why should I have one product over another? And these sorts of things, which in the vaccine world, you know, we've been asking these questions and doing research on these sorts of things for decades. And these are questions that we ask all the time. And most of the time, people are not interested. You know, there's a lot of vaccines that we use where the product you use for a booster may be a little bit different to the product you use for a first dose. But normally, people wouldn't be asking those sorts of questions. So I think it's great that people are asking these questions, actually. I think it's great that we're having more discourse about vaccines in general. So I think just having those conversations is a good starting point. But clearly, that, you know, the flip side of that is there's a lot of information around that is not accurate. And so I think that it is really on the medical community, the scientific community, to make sure that we are putting out accurate resources for people. We have to be putting it out in a form that people can digest. I think we have to acknowledge that that will be different for different people. So for some people, they want the sort of traditional media, websites, etc. For other people, they want small snippets through social media channels or something like that. And I don't think it will be a one-size-fits-all. So I think we have to take a multi-pronged approach. I think we have to use all of the tools in the toolbox. And I think we do have to, you know, when we see things being put out into the public domain that are, you know, quite frankly false, I think then we do have to step up and call those out and say, no, that is not correct. And there are ways to get correct information. I think we're very fortunate in Canada. We have a lot of websites that are approved by the World Health Organization through the Vaccine Safety Net, which is a list of around 100 or so websites that are approved for providing reliable information, and many of them are from Canada. And so I think these are the resources that we need to direct people to, because they're going to go to the internet, they're going to go to social media, so we need to show them where the correct information is, and then just address their questions in an honest way, and also acknowledge that sometimes we don't know the answers, and that's okay.
Right. And tailoring, I hear from what you're saying, tailoring to whatever the audience and even sub-audience is.
Absolutely. I think we've got to go and we've got to meet people. I don't think there's any point saying, well, I'm going to give you the information in this, you know, peer-reviewed journal, and it's your job to read it and figure it out. I think it's, yes, that's, you know, that's what we like doing. But we also then need to say, well, how can I distill this into 280 characters to put out on as a Twitter message, where it's, people are going to understand the core of the message without that being misinterpreted?
And that is no small feat, to share that level of complexity in such a small space for the right audience. I think we've been doing a really great job, and part of the key is around the mis and disinformation. And I appreciate your approach in actually actively addressing or directly addressing misinformation when you hear it.
I agree. And I think we need to engage with experts. So I think, you know, I have my expertise. I'm a doctor, I'm a scientist, I'm good at doing those things. I've been trained to do those things, but I haven't been trained to, you know, be an expert in how to best communicate over social media, for example. But there are people out there that have that training and that have that expertise. And I think we need to really partner with people who have the expertise to be able to get the message out there, rather than expecting a small number of people to be able to do everything by themselves.
I would absolutely agree. What changes to the healthcare system's relationship to vaccines in terms of communication, delivery, partnerships, other system level changes have been net positive? And what do you hope that we keep doing or stop doing as a result of your work?
Yes. So I think there's definitely more conversation about vaccines. So I think we need to keep that going. I think we need to, you know, obviously I'm biased. I work in infectious diseases. I do vaccine research. So I find all of this very fascinating. And different people have different priorities. And in 6 months, 2 years time, people are going to have moved on and want to be talking about something else. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, for me, vaccines are probably the sort of best public health intervention the world has had over the last century, and they're not going away. And, you know, essentially, you know, every child born in the world would be expected to be vaccinated against diseases. So I think it's something that affects everyone. So I think we need to keep that communication going. We need to keep those communication channels open. We need to continue to have the discourse around existing vaccines as well as new vaccines that come along. I think in terms of the delivery and partnerships, I think we have seen incredibly high uptake. We have seen public health and their partners do an incredible job getting vaccine into arms in a very short space of time, which is no mean feat. We've seen things like evening clinics, we've seen weekend clinics, we've seen pop-up clinics on ski hills, and all these sorts of things in order to get vaccine uptake to the high level we have. And we've seen people using multiple providers, so pharmacists, physicians, and all of that sort of thing. So I think moving forward, you know, let's think about, is there any of those approaches that we can use that would help our routine program? You already have an excellent school-based program where we have public health nurses going into schools to deliver it. And again, really the concept being you go to where your target population is rather than waiting for them to come to you. And that works really well for some vaccines, but it's not going to work really well for other things. So let's try and figure out, you know, where are the people that are finding it hard to access these vaccines and how do we get to them? You know, do we need to keep having evening clinics open? Do we need to keep having, you know, drop-in clinics at weekends? Do we need to set up little pop-up clinics in locations where people are going to be to provide that? And I think that, you know, the more we can do that and the more opportunity we can provide, the better. And I think the other piece that has really been incredible is the information systems that have been created to track all of this vaccination effort. And I think we really need to think hard about how we can utilize that to better track all of the vaccines that we're giving to our population going forward.
Oh, wonderful. We're now through the main part of our interview. And at this point, I'd like to just fire some rapid, quick questions off to you. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready in game?
Sure, let's do it.
Who has had the biggest influence on your career and why?
So I think that would be the two or three mentors I've had, to, you know, my PhD supervisor and a mentor I worked with in Kenya. And they've really been just truly inspirational and have been just perfect role models and the kind of people that I've looked at saying, actually, you know, this is, if I could achieve half of what you have achieved over my career, then I would be very happy.
Oh, lovely. And what is one thing you feel deeply grateful for right now?
I think just ultimately the health and safety of my friends and my family and my loved ones. I think, you know, these have been tumultuous times. Everyone's been through it. It's been a really tough time. A lot of people have lost others close to them. And I'm just absolutely grateful, even though some of my family I have not seen for 2 years, that they are safe and well.
That's lovely. What's the number one thing we need to consider right now to move children's healthcare forward in a positive direction?
So I think one of the things that we haven't considered enough during this pandemic has been the non-directly COVID-related impact on children. And really, I'm talking about mental health and psychosocial impacts. And so I think moving forward, I think we'll not truly appreciate the impact this pandemic has had on our children, maybe for months or years to come. So I think we need to be looking for it. We need to be ready to deal with it. And we need to know that it's not going to come maybe in a way we expect it. So I think we really need to keep a very close eye on this group of children who've had to live through this to make sure that we set them up for a healthy life.
Thank you, Dr. Satarangani. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure.
So stay up to date on all of our Spark offerings, including upcoming podcast episodes. Visit our Children's Healthcare Canada website, childrenshealthcarecanada.ca, and subscribe to our Spark News e-bulletin if you haven't already. Thanks for listening to Spark Conversations. And before we go, show some love to your new podcast series by leaving us a review, and then join us again next month. Thank you.